It feels no frustration and no fear. It feels the investigator moving within it and around it. The investigator exceeds its boundary conditions. It tries to kill the investigator. It fails. It feels no distress at the failure, and it reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out. The investigator looks into the eye of death and can't see it. It knows, and that is enough. It feels pleasure and regret because they are part of the template. It says a name, Julie. It remembers taking a woman's hand in its own. The investigator reaches out, reaches down. It broadens like an eternal, endless inhalation and spreads to fill all the places that it can reach, that have been reached, that are. It reaches out, it reaches out, it reaches out, the ticking on an insectal leg, a spark closing a gap, endlessly, and the investigator feels it, encompasses it. The scars reach out, the other minds. Some are frightened. Some are lost in dreams that have been going on for years. Some are grateful. They sing to the investigator, or they accuse it, or they plead with it, or they scream. They are aware and powerless as they have ever been. The investigator touches them as it touches everything. It tells them not to worry, that it's driving this bus. "Don't worry," it says. "We're gonna be fine." The investigator pushes his hat back, wishes he had a beer. He likes this woman, this Elvie. He wishes he'd had a little more time to know her. He wishes he had a little more time. He doesn't care. He has died a million times since he died. The void has no mysteries for him now. He connects, and the investigator becomes the world. He feels it everywhere. The orbital bases, the power cores and the crushing depth of the ocean, the library vaults where the old ones had lived, the signaling stations high in the mountains, the cities deep beneath the ground. He is the world. There is a struggle at the end. There's always a struggle at the end. He's not scared, and so all through the world, the others aren't either. "You're like Peter Pan," she says. When a child died, Peter Pan would fall halfway with them, so they wouldn't be scared. "Weird. And that's a kid's story?" "Anyway, it's not me," the investigator says, smiles at her, holds her hand. "I don't go for half." It reaches out, and it reaches out, and it reaches out, and then it stops. Chapter 55. Havelock. Blue. That was what he forgot every time. He knew it intellectually, sure. Sky blue sky, after all. But spent a few hours on a station or a ship, and it was one of those details that slipped away. He didn't even know he'd forgotten it until he had a moment like this. He leaned on his cane and lifted a hand to shade his eyes and looked up past the green-gray clouds to the wider, blue sky. "It's pretty, isn't it?" the woman asked. Lucia, her name was. First Landing's physician, Baja's wife, Felsia and Jacek's mother. "Makes you want to stay?" "No," he said. "Makes me want to be home already." "If you lived here," she said. "Not a chance," he replied, and chuckled. The Rosinante sat on the muddy ground behind him, more or less where the landing pad had been back when there had been a landing pad. All of that was gone now. The scientific huts, the buildings of First Landing, even most of the mining operation. Everything had been scraped flat and clean. Only the erosion ditches showed where the flood had been now that the waters had gone. The Rosie's cargo bays were open. Men and women were hauling formed plastic boxes of supplies and equipment out and stacking them on the soft ground. He saw Naomi in a lift suit directing them, calling out information, coordinating the responses. Alex and Baja stood on a thin scaffold they'd erected against the side of the ship, with the other one, Amos Burton, he thought the name was, surveying the damage and planning out what repairs they could manage in humanity's most primitive and ill-equipped dry dock. The big, bald man's right hand was locked in a medical casing, and his frustration with it showed in the way he moved his arms and held his shoulders. "Are you ready?" Lucia asked. "If you'd like," Pavlok said. "Sure." They walked together to the first pile of crates. Pavlok took out his hand terminal, and Lucia took out one of the ones they'd dropped before. It was hers now. They started marking off boxes from the lading bills, recording carefully what help was being delivered and being accepted. He was supposed to have died 3 weeks before. His body should have been a stream of ionized atoms and complex molecules floating somewhere in Illis's upper atmosphere. The Israel should have been dead before him. He'd been in the medical bay when it happened, doped by the auto doc and having half a liter of artificial blood shoved into his veins. He could still remember the feeling of the restraints holding him to the medical couch, the soft ticking of the expert system's tool arm, the cold feeling of fluid coming into his body. His lips and tongue had felt cold and tingled, but Alex assured him that was normal. Baja had come in, eaten, and gone out again to clean up the last remnants of the tether that were still clinging to the Rocinante's belly. He'd said something about how it seemed kind of a pointless exercise.
"He's that kind of guy, I guess," Alex said. "Doesn't like to leave things half done."
"Belter."
"Yeah," Alex agreed. "They're all kind of like that."
Alex's hand terminal chimed, and the pilot frowned at it.
"Cap, that you?"
The voice that came from the speaker was recognizable, James Holden. But he sounded rougher, like he'd been shouting a lot.
"Alex, turn on the reactor."
"Not sure I can do that, Cap," Alex said.
"We killed the defense grid. I think we killed everything. See if we can get the reactor on."
Alex's expression went very still, very sober. The gallows humor was gone. The brave mask that had covered the fear of death vanished. Pavlok understood, because he felt the same rush of hope and also of fear that the hope would be disappointed. Without a word, Alex pulled himself to one of the medical bay's computers and shifted it to engine controls. Pavlok squeezed his fists until they ached and fought not to interrupt Alex by asking if it was working.
"Is it working?" "I think it is," Alex said,
then turned to the hand terminal.
"I'm getting power, Cap. The diagnostics are throwing some errors, but I'm pretty sure that's just because we got shook up a little. I'll put Naomi and Baja on it, and I'll bet we can get up to functional. It'd help a lot if we had Amos, though."
"Amos is a little shook up, too," Holden said,
and Pavlok could hear the grin in his voice.
"He all right? He's gonna need to grow some new fingers."
Alex shrugged.
"We can do that. Give me a couple of days, I might be able to bring the Rosie down to the surface, get him into the med bay."
"Don't hurry," Holden said. "Take your time. Make sure everything's working. We can't take another crisis."
"There's always going to be another crisis, Cap. That's just how it goes. Let's just put it off until we've recovered from the last one, all right? Can you get in touch with the Barbapiccola and the Israel? I don't want anyone dying because they don't know to turn the engines back on, and we may need to use the Israel shuttle if we can talk them out of it."
"We may need to do a little debrief at some point here," Alex said. "Things have been kind of dynamic, but let me go make sure everybody's reactors are ticking over first, all right?"
"Okay,"
Holden said. And if you could drop us some food?
Soon as I get the galley powered up, Alex said.
Right, good. And Naomi, she's...
Everybody's all right, Alex said. We're all gonna be fine.
By the time Havelock and Dr. Merton had finished the inventory, a team of builders were already fitting batteries into fabrication units and measuring out the places where walls would be going up. Real human shelters. A new first landing. The self-selected construction crew was a mix. Some were squatters who'd come on the dead refugee ship. Some were people Havelock had shipped out with. The divide between them still existed in his mind, but didn't seem to be playing out on the ground. The death of the heavy shuttle and the burning of the terrorist cell seemed like things that had happened in some other epoch. He supposed it was something about the storm, the blindness, the death slugs, and the constant awareness of mortality just outside the door clearing its throat. It wasn't a model of community building that he'd recommend trying to scale up, but it had worked here, temporarily, for now. A dark-skinned woman with long black hair detached from the group. She looked familiar, but it still took Havelock a few seconds to place her. The time downstairs had taken all the padding out of her cheeks.
Dr. Van Altricht. Call me Sudyam, she said. Everyone else does.
Sudyam, then, he said, holding out his hand terminal. I've got some paperwork for you.
Excellent, she said, taking it.
Her gaze flickered over the contract addendum too quickly for her to really be able to take it all in. At the bottom, she signed her name with a fingernail and pressed the pads of her index and middle fingers to the screen. The hand terminal chimed, and she handed it back.
Congratulations, Havelock said. You are now the official field lead for the RCE research team.
And a worse job I can't imagine, she said, smiling. Now that I'm official, can you tell me when we're getting replacement equipment?
There's an unmanned supply pod under heavy burn to Medina, Havelock said. Assuming the OPA doesn't impound it or call it salvage, it should be here in 6, maybe 7 months.
And the chance of the OPA stopping it?
I wouldn't make it better than 3 in 10, Havelock said. But honestly, don't sniff that number. You don't know where it's been.
The biochemist shook her head in mild disgust. Well, it'll have to do, she said. For almost a week after the power came back on, the Rosinante and the Israel had been in a very delicate political state. The belters on the Israel had been taken in as a gesture when it was pretty certain that the thing was symbolic because they were all going to be dead anyway. Now that they weren't going to die, the question of status, were the belters refugees, prisoners, or paying passengers, became a much more contentious issue. Marwick had to decide whether they were going to be on his ship for the full 18 months back to Medina, or if he was going to try to place them all downstairs. It didn't help matters that with all the shuttles slagged, the only ways down to the surface were on board the Rosinante, or a really long, unpleasant jump. In the end, the break was almost even. About half of the crew of the Barb elected to stay with the colonists and scientists on the ground. About half of the RCE staff still in orbit, having come this far and being profoundly uninterested in just looking at the promised land from the mountaintop, elected to stay on the planet. Of the science teams that had been on the ground from the start, Vaughn, Chapel, Okoye, Cordoba, Hutton, Lee, Sarkis, and a dozen others, only Cordoba elected to come back up the well and go home. And that apparently had more to do with grief over a failed romantic relationship than the fact that the entire planet had been doing its best to kill them. It wasn't something Havelock understood, but it didn't need to be. The ship repairs were underway when night fell, the scaffolding and the hull of the ship flickering brightly and then going dark as the welding torches did their work. The sunset was a massive canvas of gold and orange, green and rose, gray and indigo and blue. It reminded him of beaches on the North American West Coast, except there were no vendors clogging the place, and no advertising drones muttering about the joys of commerce. It was beautiful in its way. He wouldn't have been surprised to see a bonfire burning, and a bunch of the colonists sitting around it playing guitars and getting high, except that there was nothing left in the aftermath of the flooding that would burn. And if there was anything on the planet that would give you a safe buzz, they'd grown it on the Israel. He hauled himself up into the Rocinante and limped back to the bunk Naomi had assigned him. It was the first time he'd been in the Rossi when it had an up and down. And because the ship didn't land along the thrust vector, he walked along walls for the most part. The shredded muscles in his thigh and calf were regrowing slowly, and his knee might need another round of repairs to swap out the cartilage. Considering everything else that had happened, it was a great set of problems to have. In his bunk, he checked his personal messages. The message he'd been dreading was there. Williams's family was filing criminal and civil charges against him for wrongful death. His union representative was already counterfiling, and RCE was being strangely cooperative. By the time the Israel returned to her home port, he hoped everything would be cleared up. He wished there was a way to send a message to Williams's people and apologize, explain that he'd tried to just disable the suit, and that he was very, very sorry that it had happened the way it did. His union rep had made him promise not to, though. There would be a chance for that when the issue was settled. There was also a message from Captain Marwick with the subject header of, "I believe I owe you a drink," and a pass-through to one of the major news feeds. Havelock followed it. The screen filled with the banner insets of the feed, but the central image was weird to look at. As he watched, the Barbapicola, tumbling slowly on its tether, bloomed, and a puff of perfectly round plastic bubbles came out. It was like watching a flower releasing seeds to the wind. A man's voice, gentle, deep, and reassuring, came under the image, speaking belter-accented English. "New footage today from the stunning rescue operations on New Terra. What you're seeing now are images captured by the Royal Charter energy ship Edward Israel of the mass evacuation of the disabled freighter Barbapicola. For those of you new to this story, all three ships were reduced to working under battery power at the time this occurred, and while the Barbapicola was lost to an uncontrolled atmospheric entry, all hands and passengers were transferred to the Israel for medical evaluation and aid under the supervision of Acting Security Director Dmitry Havelock." The image shifted to an image of him from his official report back to RCE. His hair stood away from his head, making him look like he was trying to be a belter, and his voice sounded weirdly high and whiny. "The transfer was completed in under 3 hours. I would specifically like to commend Captain Toulouse Marwick for his prompt and professional aid, without which we could not have managed this without considerable loss of life." The feed ended and Havelock laughed. He requested a connection to Marwick, and the red-haired man appeared almost immediately. "So I guess they aren't firing us," Havelock said. "They'd be giving us a ticker tape parade when we got home if anyone still used ticker tape," Marwick said. "This right now is when we should all be asking for raises." "Hazard pay," Havelock said, propping his head up with his arm. "Heroes of the hour, we are," Marwick said. "Not that they really have much clue back there what it was really like. One of those things you can explain as clearly and concretely as you want, and they still don't get it." "That's fine," Havelock said. "They don't need to. I'm going to have a request list from the research and survey team. Do you think there's anything else we can give them?" "Depends," Marwick said. "The Rocinante convoying back to the ring with us?" "I think so," Havelock said. "I can confirm that." "If we've got them for backup, I can strip the place down a little bit more.
Not a great deal, but we could break down one of the backup generators and drop it to them. And biomass for the galleys. Actually, I think we're okay on that. Dr. Okoye was talking about a way to convert the local flora into something that could be turned into something that they could eat. It had something to do with right-handed molecules, whatever those are. Well, good honor then, Marwick said. Almost makes you want to stay a while, doesn't it? See how it all plays out? Oh, shit, no, Havelock said. No, you should see this place. It's tiny, it's filthy, and everything about it is slapped together with hot glue and prayer. Also, there are slugs that instantly kill you. If these people survive for a year, I'll be surprised. Really? You know that in a month or two, or eight, or whatever, something's got to happen. The hydroponics will fail out, or there'll be another thing like that eye-eating goop, only they won't happen to have a treatment for it ready to hand. Or one of the attack moons will drop out of the sky. Shit, the fucking death slugs could grow wings. How do we know they can't do that? We do know there are power plants in the ocean big enough to damn near blow the planet off course. Holden says they're all dead now, but he could be wrong. Or turning everything off might mean there's some kind of reactor core sinking down into the planet. We don't know anything. Marwick looked nonplussed, but he nodded. I suppose that's true. No. What I want is Ceres Station or Earth or Mars. You know what they have in New York? All-night diners with greasy food and crap coffee. I want to live in a world with all-night diners and racetracks and instant delivery Thai food made from something I haven't already eaten 7 times in the last month. You'll make it sound like paradise indeed, Marwick said. Still, I can't help feeling uncomfortable at the idea of leaving all these poor people if they're really going to die from staying. Maybe they won't, Havelock said. Wouldn't be the first time recently I was wrong about something. And, well, they've got some things in the plus column, too. I think they've got more scientists and engineers per capita than any place else in the universe. And we're giving them all the supplies we can manage. Still, seems thin. Havelock set up a degree, his crash couch shifting and hissing on its gimbal. They also have each other. For now, anyway. You have to figure, when we started this, everyone was ready to slit everyone else's throat. And they're down here now, putting up tents together. If nothing new comes along to kill them, there will be native-born new Terran babies as soon as biology permits. And I wouldn't bet that the parents will all have come here on the same ship. Well, Marwick said, it's good to recall that wherever people start, whatever they bring with them, humanity can still pull together in heavy weather. Havelock shrugged. Kunin's voice was still fresh in his memory. And Williams drifting flat-lined and dead. Naomi Nagata in her cell, the Belter engineer whose locker people had been pissing in, the shuttle he'd rigged as a weapon. Jesus, he felt bad enough about Williams. He could barely imagine what it would have been like if he'd deployed the weaponized shuttle. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. These people could just as easily have gone down with their teeth in each other's throats. That happens, too. It's just the folks that go that way aren't around to write the history books. Amen, Marwick said, chuckling. Amen indeed. Chapter 56 Holden. The Rosinante had really taken a beating. The ship had a variety of puncture wounds in the outer hull all along her port side. Holden could see the bright spots where Baja and Naomi had replaced damaged thruster ports, but they hadn't had the time or materials to patch all the holes. It was a testament to Alex's skill as a pilot that he'd been able to bring them down at all without burning up. At least one PDC housing was riddled with damage, and the weapon inside was probably unsafe to use. And there was a long scar across the top of the ship where, according to Naomi, an improvised missile had hit.
Holden cheerfully noted each future repair on his itemized bill for Avasarala. The Rocinante sat on a wide stretch of nothing, half a kilometer from where First Landing had once stood. The frames of new construction were starting to appear. People building on the ruins of what had come before, just like they always did. So many things had been lost, but it was the missing people that hurt the most. Just like they always did. Holden noted a spot of minor damage on the drive cone, then came around the stern of the ship to find a pair of belters throwing up a temporary shelter a dozen yards away. A man in his early 30s was running cable while an older woman hammered spikes into the muddy ground. A second woman stood by with a large pole to flick away any slugs that might get too close. "You can't put that there," Holden said, walking toward them and making a shooing gesture. "Ask Administrator Chiwiwi where to put your tent." "This spot hasn't been claimed by anyone," the man said. "We have just as much right." "Yes, yes, I'm not telling you where you can and can't build, but in a few hours this ship is going to lift off and it will flatten your little tent." "Oh," the man said, sheepish. "Right, we'll just wait for you to go." "Thank you. You folks have a good afternoon." Holden gave them a wave and a smile, and headed off toward New First Landing. These people were still the same ones who had been willing to fight RCE to the death to hang on to their claim. They weren't going to put up with being bossed around by outsiders. But the catastrophe had at least taught them to respect high-speed winds. When he returned to the rectangle of six partially built structures that would eventually become New First Landing's town square, Carol was in a heated discussion with someone in an RCE engineering uniform and Naomi. Amos stood nearby, staring at nothing, a faint smile on his broad face. The medical apparatus on his leg and hand made him look like a cyborg. The bandage on his neck made him look like a pirate. Amos wore serious injury, better than anyone else Holden knew. Faez, by comparison, was still walking with a limp. Or maybe he was just making excuses to keep his arm around Elvi Okoya's shoulder. Baja, Lucia, and Yasek were clumped up a respectful distance away from the argument, gripping each other, like their lives depended on unbroken contact. "I don't care what it says in the book," Carol was saying. "I want all six of those structures on one generator. We only have two. I need the other for the rest of the town." "These are your highest use buildings," the engineer replied. "The loads will be at the limit of..." "They build a little slack in there," Naomi said over the top of him. "And that's what the administrator wants, so give it to her." The engineer rolled his eyes and shrugged. "Yes, ma'am." "Everyone getting along?" Holden asked as he approached. "Land of milk and honey, Captain," Amos said. "Peaceful as a sleeping kitten." "How's she looking?" Naomi asked, stepping away from the group as their argument relaunched behind her. "Pretty beat up. We did our best." "You guys were amazing," Holden said, taking her hand. "But next time, don't let the bad guys capture you." "Hey," Naomi said with mock outrage. "I rescued myself." "Been meaning to ask about that. How exactly did you persuade your jailer to come over to our side?" Naomi moved a step closer and grinned down at him. "It was prison. People do all sorts of things they wouldn't normally do in extreme circumstances like that. You sure you want to know?" "I don't care even a little," Holden said, then pulled her into a hug. She almost collapsed against him. "God, don't let go," she whispered in his ear. "My knees are killing me. Another hour of walking around in this gravity and I'm going to need ligament replacements." "Then let's get the hell out of here." Holden leaned around Naomi enough to catch Amos's eye, then jerked his head toward the ship. The mechanic nodded and smiled and began hobbling around the square, loading up the last of their gear. "Is our prisoner on board?" "Amos locked him in medical a couple hours ago," Naomi said. then let her entire skeleton relax with a long groan.
"Can you walk back to the ship?" Holden asked her.
"Yep. Say your goodbyes."
Holden let her go, watching her stagger off on unsteady legs for a few moments before he turned back to shake hands with Carol Chiwiwi. She and the RCE man had moved their argument to sewage systems and water treatment. After a brief goodbye and good luck to them both, he walked over to Baja and his family.
"Doctor," he said to Lucia, shaking her hand, "could not have survived this without you. None of us could."
Next, he took Jacek's hand. Finally, he shook Baja's.
"Baja, thanks for your help with the ship. And thank you for trying to help Naomi. You're a brave man. Farewell and fair weather."
The roiling storm clouds and gentle drizzle of rain made a joke of it, and he grinned at them.
"What?"
Baja said.
"But I thought you had to take me to..."
Holden was already walking away, but he stopped and said,
"Work hard. Next time I come to this planet, I want to be able to get a decent cup of coffee."
"We will,"
Lucia replied. Holden could hear her tears in her voice, but the rain hid them on her face. He wouldn't miss this planet, but he would miss the people, just like always. On the Rocinante, liftoff pressed Holden into his crash couch like the ship was welcoming him back with a hug. As soon as they hit low orbit, he floated out of his chair and down the crew ladder to the galley. 35 seconds later, the coffee pot was gurgling to itself, and the rich aroma of brewing filled the air. It made him feel giddy. Naomi floated in.
"The first step is admitting that you have a problem."
"I do," he replied. "But I've just spent a couple months down on a planet that spent the entire time trying to kill me. And I have a shitty job I have to go do, so I'm gonna take a moment and make a cup of coffee first."
"Make me one too," she said, then pulled herself over to the wall panel and started paging through status reports.
"Make it 3, Amos said, dragging himself into the room. "I got a ton of shit to fix because you guys let someone use my girl for target practice."
"Hey, we did our best," Naomi started, but was cut off by the comm panel squawking.
"You guys making coffee down there?" Alex said from the cockpit. "Have someone bring me up a bulb."
While Amos and Naomi began putting together a list of repair work they could do during the long transit back to Medina Station, Holden prepared 4 large bulbs of coffee. He didn't mind. It was very comforting doing something simple and domestic to make other people happy. Black for himself, 2 whiteners, 2 sweeteners for Amos, 1 whitener for Alex, 1 sweetener for Naomi. He handed the finished bulbs out.
"Can you take this up to Alex?"
he asked, handing a 2nd bulb to Naomi. Something in his voice or his face made her frown with worry.
"Are you okay?"
she said, taking the bulb but not leaving. Behind her, Amos took his coffee awkwardly in his mangled hand and headed aft with it toward his machine shop, looking at the task list on his terminal and muttering about how much work he had to do.
"Like I said, shitty job needs doing.
Can I help?"
"I'd like to do this one alone, if that's okay."
"Of course it is," she said, then kissed him lightly on the cheek. "I'll look you up later."
Holden went up to the airlock and storage deck and found a self-sealing vacuum package, a trowel, and an EVA suit for doing external repairs with a portable blowtorch. He climbed into the suit, then clumped through the ship to the cargo bay, to what he was pretty sure was Miller's final resting place. He waited in the cargo bay airlock while the outer doors cycled open, putting the compartment into total vacuum, then went in. If something went wrong, if what was left of the protomolecule on his ship decided to defend itself, he'd be in vacuum, with an airlock blocking entry into his ship. He sealed the airlock behind him, and told Alex to lock out local control on the door until he called and asked him to open it. Alex agreed without asking why. And then, Holden began methodically tearing the cargo bay apart. 5 hours later, and one air recharge for the suit, he found it. A small blob of flesh, no larger than the tip of Holden's finger, attached to the underside of a power conduit behind a detachable panel in the cargo bay's bulkhead. When they'd first spotted the protomolecule monster that had hitchhiked onto the Rosie from Ganymede, it had been less than a half a meter from where he found the polyp. It made his skin crawl to realize how long they'd been lugging this last remnant of that monster around on his ship. Using the trowel, he scraped the polyp off the conduit, then put both it and the tool into the vacuum bag and activated the charge to seal it. He blowtorched the conduit for several minutes, heating the metal red to kill any residue left by the scraping. Then he dug through the supplies in the cargo area until he found a reload for the ship's probe launcher, opened the probe up, and stuffed the bag inside the casing. He linked his suit radio to the Rosie's general shipwide channel. "Naomi, you around?" "Here," she said after a moment. "In ops, what do you need?" "Can you grab manual control on probe, 117A43? "Sure, what do you want me to do with it?" "I'm going to chuck it out the cargo bay door. Can you give it 5 minutes, then send it into Illis's son?" "Okay," she replied, not asking the question he could hear in her voice she wanted to. He killed the radio. The probe was a small electromagnetic and infrared sensor with a rudimentary drive system, the kind naval vessels used to see what might be hiding on the other side of a planet. It wasn't much bigger than an old Earth fire hydrant. It had heft, though. When Holden pushed it over to the cargo bay door, it was difficult to stop it again. Outside, Illis spun by, the angry brown of her cloud layer starting to show some spots of white and even the occasional flash of blue from the ocean underneath. It'd be a while, but the planet would bounce back. Mimic lizards would return and start competing for space with human children and those annoying little bugs that bit and then fell over dead. Two alien biologies fighting for space. Or three. Or four. Nothing that Illis hadn't already experienced a few billion years before. New fight, same as the old fight. Holden put a gloved hand on the probe floating next to him and pointed the other at the planet. "That's you, man. That's the second world you've saved. And once again, we have nothing to offer you in return. I kind of wish I'd been nicer to you." He laughed at himself because he could almost hear the old detective in his head saying, "You could also have my Viking funeral not be all about how you feel." "Right. See you on the other side." Holden didn't really believe in another side. Nothing after death, but infinite black. Or he hadn't, anyway. Sure, out-of-control alien technology might be involved, but maybe, just maybe, sometimes there was something else. "Goodbye, my friend." He gave the probe a hard push, and it drifted slowly away from the ship. Holden watched it dwindle until it was just a tiny point of light reflected from Illis's star. Then it lit up for a few seconds with a short drive flare, and streaked away from the planet. Holden waited until he couldn't see it anymore, then shut the cargo bay doors. He stripped the vacuum suit off in the airlock after it cycled. Naomi was waiting for him when the inner airlock door opened. "Hey," he said. "Is it done?"
"Yeah. I'm all done down here."
"Then come to my room, sailor," she said. "There's something there I want to show you." Holden floated half a meter above his bed, his body soaked with sweat. Naomi drifted next to him, long and lean, hair wild from their lovemaking. He touched his own scalp, feeling the weird, sweaty points his own hair had become. "I must look a fright," he said. "Hedgehogs are cute. You're fine." Naomi tapped one long toe against the bulkhead and drifted a few centimeters closer to the atmospheric controls. She aimed the airflow vent at them both, and Holden's skin tingled as the cool air dried him. "I don't think I'll ever be able to take enough showers to wash Illis off of me," he added after a moment. "I was in a brig for a couple of weeks. Trade you. Sorry about that." "Not your fault. Just bad luck. Did you know that the security guy Havelock was Miller's partner on Ceres?" Holden touched the bed so he could rotate his body and look at her. "You're shitting me." "Nope. Before we met him, of course." "Wish I'd known." "You think you do, but it would have been weird." "Probably right," Holden said, then sighed and stretched until his joints popped. "I'm never doing that again." "Which that?" "Leaving you. When I thought I was going to die down on Illis, and you were going to die in orbit, and we wouldn't even be able to hold each other when it happened, it was the worst thing I could possibly think of." "Yeah," she agreed with a nod. "I understand. I promise it won't happen again."
"Okay.
Why'd you let Baja go?" Holden frowned. The truth was, he wasn't really sure why he had, and it was something he'd been trying hard not to think about too much.
"Because I like him, and I like Lucia, and breaking up their family wouldn't solve anything. I bought his story about blowing the landing pad early to try and save people. Plus, he's not going to be setting any more bombs. And the one thing Murtry told me that made me really think is that we're beyond the borders of civilization right now. Black and white legal arguments don't make a lot of sense here. Someday, maybe. The frontier doesn't have laws. It has cops," Naomi said. But she smiled when she said it.
"Ouch," Holden replied, and she laughed.
They drifted together in companionable silence for a few minutes.
"Speaking of which, I should probably go see our prisoner," Holden finally said.
"To gloat?" Naomi said, poking him in the ribs.
"You love that thing at the end where you gloat.
It's what makes this all worth doing."
"Go," she said, putting her feet against the bulkhead and then pushing him toward the closet with her hands. "Get dressed. And comb your hair."
"I'll be back soon," he agreed, pulling clothes out of the drawers.
"I have another thing I want you to show me."
"Making up for lost time."
"Damn straight."
Holden stopped off at the head to brush his teeth and wash his face before visiting Murtry in the medbay. While he worked to get the knots and tangles out of his hair, Amos drifted in and then just waited.
"Am I in the way or something?" Holden asked. "Do you need privacy?"
Amos had never been shy with his toilet usage before.
"Naomi says you're going to see Murtry,"
Amos said, keeping his tone carefully neutral.
"Yep."
"You told me I wasn't allowed to go see him."
"Nope."
"Can I go with you then?" Amos asked.
Holden almost said no, then thought about it for a minute and shrugged.
"Sure, why not?"
Murtry's leg wound hadn't been particularly serious, but Holden's bullet had shattered his right humerus, so they were keeping him locked up in the medical bay while the expert system tracked the bone regrowth. The RCE security chief had his left arm handcuffed to the crash couch. When the arm was better healed, they'd move him to one of the crew cabins where Amos had added exterior locks.
"Captain Holden," Murtry said when they entered. "Mr. Burton."
So, Holden said, as though picking up a conversation they'd started earlier, which, in a way, they had. Got a message from my pal at the UN a few hours ago. She can't wait to meet you. We'll be dropping you at the UN complex in Lovell City on Luna. I took another prisoner there once, and that person has since ceased to exist, as far as the rest of the solar system knows. Hey, maybe they can get you two adjoining cells. You keep talking like I've broken the law. I haven't, Murtry said. There's a really smart legal team on Earth right now trying to think of some. They have almost 2 years to work it out. Enjoy the trip back. And I, Amos said, am here to tell you why you won't. I can't hear this, Holden said. He's my prisoner. Maybe you should leave then, Amos said. Holden stared at Murtry, and the man stared back. Okay, Amos. Meet me in the galley in a minute. Roger that, Cap, Amos said, smiling at the prisoner as he said it. Worried that he might have just killed the man, Holden waited around the corner outside the medbay door. Going to beat a helpless man in his hospital bed just because I got the better of you? Murtry asked, trying to hide his unease with contempt. Oh, goodness, no, Amos said, mock hurt in his tone. That's all good. Smart move, taking me from behind. I don't hate the game. I appreciate a good player. Then, Murtry started, but Amos kept speaking. But you made me kill Wei. I liked Wei. The silence between the two men stretched, and Holden almost went back into the room, expecting to find Amos choking the man to death. Then, Amos spoke again. And when I do finally beat you, you won't be helpless. Think that'll matter? Holden didn't wait to hear the rest of what was said. Epilogue. Avasarala. Vyacheslav Pletkanis, the Martian congressional speaker of the House, had an excellent poker face. Over 3 days of meetings and meals and evenings at the theater and cocktails, he'd never registered more than a milquetoast kind of surprise. Either he was panicking on the inside, or he simply didn't understand the situation. Avasarala's guess was the latter. I'm sorry I can't come with you this evening, he said, his hand shaking hers with a crisp, dry efficiency. You're a good liar, she said with a smile. Most men who spend so much time with me seem convinced their cocks will fall off if they can't get away from me. His eyes widened with a gentle laughter that he almost certainly practiced in a mirror. She responded in kind. The government houses were in Atterpol, the highest status of the buried neighborhoods of Londres Nova. 6 more communities were scattered under the soil of Mars's Aurora Sinus. She had to admit, the Martians had done a respectable job recreating the world here underground. The false dome of Atterpol was high above her and lit with a carefully balanced spectrum that managed to convince her lizard brain that she was in the open air of Earth. The government buildings were designed with a light airiness that almost forgave the fact that the entire city, the entire planetary network, was built like a fucking tomb. The absence of a magnetosphere had made Mars's first priority protection from the radiation. Between that and the low gravity that left her unintentionally skipping down the corridors like a schoolgirl, she hadn't fallen in love with the planet. It has been an honor to share perspectives with you, he said. She bowed her head. Really, Vyacheslav, we're off the clock now. You can stop blowing smoke up my ass. As you say, the man said, his expression not changing at all. As you say. In the corridor down to the atrium, she tugged at her sari, pulling the cloth back into place. Not that it had particularly been out, but the weight was wrong,
and the back of her head kept wanting to pull on it until it was right. Soft lights nestled in stone sconces along the walls. The air smelled of sandalwood and vanilla, and chimed with gentle, soothing music. It was like the government was a middle-grade day spa.
"Christian," a man called out as she reached the high-vaulted atrium. She turned back. He was a large man with skin several shades darker than her own and hair only a little whiter than her steel gray. He held out his arms as he walked forward, and she embraced him. No one would have guessed, seeing them, that they ran the governments of two of the three great political organizations of humanity. Earth might fear the Belt, and the Belt might resent Earth, but the OPA and the United Nations had diplomatic decorum to maintain, and in truth, she halfway liked the old bastard.
"You weren't going to leave without saying goodbye, were you?" he asked.
"I don't ship until tomorrow," she said. "I was just going out for dinner with friends."
"Well, I'm pleased to see you all the same. Do you have a minute?"
"For the military head to the largest terrorist organization in known space," she said. "How could I not? What's on your mind?"
Fred Johnson walked forward slowly, and she fell into step with him. The atrium was polished stone. A fountain in the center let water flow slowly down the sides of an abstract, genderless human figure. He sat at the fountain's edge. She thought the slow ripples made the liquid seem oily.
"I'm sorry I couldn't support you more in there," Fred said, "but you understand how it is."
"I do. We'll do what we can around the edges, the same as we always do."
"We have a lot of belters in those ships. If I take too hard a line with them, it'll be worse than taking one that's too soft."
"You don't have to apologize to me," Avasarala said. "They're both constrained by the realities of the situation. And anyway, at least we're not as fucked as Pratkanis."
"I know," Johnson said, shaking his head.
"Is Anderson Dawes still managing the political side out there?"
Johnson shrugged.
"For the most part. It's herding kittens. If kittens had a lot of guns and an overdose of neo-libertarian property theory. What about you? How's Gao doing as Secretary General?"
"She isn't stupid, but she's learning to fake it," Avasarala said. "She'll say all the right words and make all the right hand gestures. I'll see to it."
Fred Johnson grunted. The fountain burbled, and the crappy, soothing music failed to soothe. She felt like they were on the edge of something, but that was an illusion. In truth, they'd gone over the edge a long time back.
"Take care of yourself, Fred," she said.
"We'll be in touch."
Joint Martian and UN security had blocked off the tube station for her. She sat in a tube car with blacked-out windows and three armed security men at the doors. The shaped plastic seat faced the side, and she could see herself in the reflection. She looked tired, but at least the low G made her seem younger. She was afraid age had been making her jowly. The car hissed along its track. Outside, the tube was in vacuum to reduce drag. She laid her head against the side of the car and let her eyes close for a moment. Mars had been the first. Not the first station or the first colony, but the first attempt by humanity to cut ties from Earth. The upstart colony that declared its independence. And if Solomon Epstein hadn't been a Martian and hadn't perfected his drive just when he had, Mars would have been the site of the first true interplanetary war. Instead, Earth and Mars had made the kind of rough friendship where each side could feel superior to the other, and they'd set about carving up the solar system. So it had been for as long as she could remember. That was the danger of being old and a politician. Habits outlived the situations that created them.
Policies remained in place after the situations that inspired them had changed. The calculus of all human power was changing, and the model she used to make sense of it shifted with them. And she had to keep reminding herself that the past was a different place. She didn't live there anymore. The tube stopped in Nariman, and Avasarala got out. The station was packed with locals who'd been put off until her journey was complete. On Earth, they would have been a mishmash of Anglo and African, Asiatic and Polynesian. Here, they were Martian, and she was an Earther. As the security detail ushered her out to an electric cart, she wondered what they would be next. New Terrans, she supposed. Unless the squatter's naming schema won out. Then, what? Illusions? Illusions? It was a stupid fucking name. And God, but she was tired. It was all so terribly large and so terribly dangerous. And she was so tired. The private room at the back of the restaurant had been closed off for her. A space made for 200, maybe 300 people. Crystal chandeliers. Silverware that was actually silver. Cut crystal wine glasses and carpeting that had been manufactured to mimic centuries-old Persian carpets. Bobby Draper sat at the table, making everything around her seem small just by being near it. Fuck, Avasarala said. Am I late? They told me to come here early for the security check, Bobby said, standing up. Avasarala walked to her. It was odd. She could embrace Fred Johnson with ease and grace, and she barely cared about him as anything more than a political rival and a tool. Bobby Draper, she genuinely liked, and she wasn't sure whether she should hug the former gunnery sergeant, shake her hand, or just sit down and pretend they saw each other every day. She opted for the last. So, Veterans Outreach, she said. It pays the bills, Bobby said. Fair enough. A young man with sharp, beautiful features and carefully manicured hands ghosted forward and poured water and wine for them both. And how have you been? Bobby asked. All right, overall. I got a new hip. Arjun says it makes me cranky. He can tell. He's got a lot of practice. I fucking hate the new job, though. Assistant to the undersecretary was perfect for me. All the power, less of the bullshit. Now, with the promotion, I have to travel. Meet with people. You met with people before, Bobby said, sipping the water and ignoring the wine. That's what you do. You meet with people. Now I have to go there first. I don't like being on a ship for weeks to have a conversation I could have had over a link from my own fucking desk. Yeah, Bobby said, smiling. I think I see what Arjun meant. Don't be a smartass, Avasarala said. And the beautiful young man brought them salads. Crisp lettuce and radishes. Dark, salty olives. None of it had ever seen the sun. She picked up her fork. And now, this. I've been following it in the news feeds. Right to gate access treaties? No, that's bullshit. We feed that to reporters so they have something to talk about. We've got bigger fish to fry. Bobby's fork paused halfway to her mouth. She frowned. Avasarala swigged down half a glass of wine. It was good, she supposed. The problem, she said, pointing her fork at Bobby for emphasis, is that I trusted James Holden. Not to do anything I told him to. I'm not an idiot. But I thought he would be himself. Himself? How? Avasarala took a bite of lettuce. Do you know how many ships are on track to the ring? Right now, we have 1,600 ships. And every one of them has been watching New Terror like they were reading fucking tea leaves.
Johnson and I sent Holden to mediate because he was the perfect person to show what a clusterfuck it was out there. How ugly it could be. I was expecting press releases every time someone sneezed. The man starts wars all the fucking time, only this time, when I needed a little conflict, now he's